Hey, buddy.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm pretty good. You know, last time one of our episodes came out, I got a text from a friend saying, "Hey, I'm actually excited your new podcast is out." And then 10 minutes later, he wrote, "Never mind, you guys really need to work on figuring out how to start the show."
I wrote a thing this week.
Hey, Eric.
I figured we would, like, bumble through the first, you know, 5 seconds like we always do, and then... Uh-huh. I was gonna come back with our little written intro.
Okay, well, go ahead.
No, it's done now.
No,
though,
now I'm really looking forward to making fun of you for whatever you came up with here.
It's not anything glamorous.
I'm sure that's true. But now I'm making you do it.
Hey everyone, it's You're Wrong with Bobby and Ian, a show where two geeks talk about their favorite popular culture. I'm Bobby, and he is Ian.
No, I don't like this.
Oh man, what's new this week, buddy?
You're wrong with Ian and Bobby. You're wrong.
What is new with me? I saw a couple of movies this week. Date Night is really, really... I'm sorry, not Date Night. Game Night is really, really good.
But Date Night fucking sucks.
I hate you. Yeah, I forgot how much of, like, a comedy treasure Rachel McAdams is. She doesn't ever do comedies, and she's really, really, really funny in it.
I recently was listening to a podcast that revisited, Mean Girls.
Yeah.
And she is great.
She absolutely stole the movie. Like, Jason Bateman is fantastic, too, but she totally stole that movie. It's fantastic. Everybody should see Game Night. It's weirdly really dark in, like, the best possible way.
I really, really want to watch it.
Yeah. Like, it's the best version of that idea. Like, all of the stakes are super grounded and real, and the comedy comes from, like, their reactions to everything. It's not, like, a slapsticky movie.
Cool.
Yeah, it's great. What else? Oh, I also saw Annihilation, which I liked a lot. I'm still, like, digesting it. I saw it on Wednesday, I think. And I read the book, obviously. I talked with you a little bit about it on the show. And it's kind of an impossible book to adapt. So they made some changes, which I'm 100% fine with. I feel like it actually captures the tone of the book super, super well. I really, really liked it. I'm still just processing it. There's a lot of ideas. But it's beautifully shot. It's a little bit more of a horror story than I thought it would be, or a little bit of a horror movie than I thought it would be, but in a good way, I think. So, I don't know. I definitely recommend Annihilation as well.
Awesome. I mean, I really very badly want to see Annihilation.
It's great.
I had a bunch of opportunities and misses this week to watch it, and I've been pretty sad about that.
What have you been doing instead with your week? What have you been up to?
Well, I have a PlayStation VR now, so that's pretty exciting. Last week when we recorded, we had just met, but I've had some time to spend with it.
Yeah, last time we recorded, you literally hadn't opened the box yet, right?
I had not. Yeah. It had arrived in the mail. I had put it aside and set up my equipment so we could record. And
so what have you
torture.
Played?
All right, so. I have very slowly been playing the first 20 minutes of Resident Evil 7, and I don't think I can do it. Like, I think I'm too scared. It just makes me very uncomfortable, and I to the point where I'm wondering if I'm having any fun, and I might just go ahead and play the game outside of VR.
Oh, that's amazing. You could just give the whole thing to me. That's fine. remember you texted me and said, "Hey, I'm in a digital living room watching Legion right now." And I said, "Well, I'm in an actual living room watching Legion right now, and I didn't spend $200 on it, but good for you, I guess."
Hulu has a VR app, which I found puzzling and kind of awesome.
And, I mean, it sounds like a funny idea. I don't know if it sounds like anything else, but...
It just generates an environment and a large screen for you to watch things. And so you could sit in a living room, you can control the time of day, you can sit on the beach, you could sit in a movie theater, and whatever you want to play will just be on screen.
That's weird.
That's kind of fun.
Does the physical space change the light on the screen? Does that question make sense?
that question does make sense, and it does not.
Okay.
So, and then it's when you focus on the screen, the rest of it kind of blurs away. So it does. Weird. You're not distracted by it.
Okay.
There's a 5-minute X-Wing mission on that got attached to Star Wars Battlefront, I think, to sell Rogue One, and it's awesome. It's the coolest thing I've ever played, where you sit in the cockpit of an X-Wing and you take down a
Star Destroyer. How would you describe it again?
Awesome.
Okay.
That
sounds really cool.
No, it's amazing.
I'm jealous of all of this, by the way. That's why I'm teasing you right now.
And then there's one more game that was that Warren's mentioning, and it's called Super Hot. Have you ever heard of Super Hot?
No.
It's
that was my nickname in high school.
No, it wasn't. I went to high school with you. It was not. I'm not going to let you have that one.
Nobody will ever let me have that one.
He said through tears. And Super Hot is like a bunch of kind of like quick action puzzles. You're like dropped into a scenario. The game has a really distinct visual style. Everyone's kind of like polygonal and everything is like red and white. That's kind of the aesthetic.
Okay.
But you're dropped into a situation where you're getting attacked. And so you either have to like reach out in front of you and disarm someone and grab their gun and shoot them, or you have to like punch someone in the face, or you grab like a cigarette holder and throw it at someone. But people only move when you move. So you can stop moving and survey the area, or like you could see bullets coming at you and you can like move to the side to dodge bullets and stuff.
Weird.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, more than any other game, that game has made me feel like I am somewhere else. Like I am a cool action movie star or something.
It sounds kind of like Permanent Bullet Time or something like that.
Yeah, or Bullet Time that you... Yeah, that's a good description for it. You just feel like you're very in control of it. But, you know, as soon as you start dodging bullets and, like, as you're dodging bullets, raising a gun to shoot someone, it's neat,
that's cool.
I guess.
Yeah, that's awesome. One of these days I'm going to convince somebody you know to videotape you doing this. I'm just, that's going to happen because I really need to see this footage.
I was playing all by myself last night. I was playing Resident Evil.
All by yourself?
All by I mean, like no one else was, everyone I live with was asleep.
Okay.
And I was playing Resident Evil and, there's a part where someone just jumps out at you, and it's a jump scare. They're not evil at that moment or anything. They just come out and go, "Hi, how are you?" And I screamed. I got caught so off guard. It was scary.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I said this last time, but I played it, you know, regular style, and I made myself play it in the dark, and I made myself sick. I, like, would have to go to the bathroom because I, like... Like, it's so scary.
There's something, there's a moment where you're crawling through water.
Yeah.
But when you have the VR headset, the water is at your chin, you know?
Yeah, like, that's, I feel like horror movies don't really scare me because they're not attacking you. It's fine, whatever, it's scary, but, like, you're not protecting yourself. And something about that extra level of protecting yourself in a game that works that well, like, is just terrifying. And, yeah, like, all of a sudden, even that's an even step further. Like, you're all of a sudden in the middle of the environment. I don't know. I don't know if I could do it either. I'm teasing you, but it might be too much for me also.
There's a thing that takes you out of it a little bit, because for whatever reason, Capcom decided to, in the VR world... you can see your hands, which is fine. And you're controlling this with a controller. You're not controlling it with the little move ones or whatever. But they cut the hands off, like, just below the wrist. So you have, like, two floating magical hands.
Yeah.
Which is okay for the most part. Except I just played a part where a character wrestles you to the ground. And you reach up and, like, grab their wrist. But it's just a floating hand that reaches up. And then you get your hand cut off.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
There's just this floating hand getting its hand cut off, and it's supposed to be a really scary moment, but it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Because it's like this magical floating hand that just becomes like a magical floating wrist.
Yes.
And I'm like, you could have done arms. It would have been fine.
They could have done arms. I mean, I feel like at a certain point, like, yeah, like until they, like, they just don't have the technology or the ability yet to build an entire body. And like, no matter where you stop it before then, it's going to be, I mean, I get what you're saying too. That's really funny. I forgot about the arm cutting off scene. Yeah. That's interesting. So you do just move around normally. Have you tried the like weird teleporting move that you have to do with the wands?
I have not. They don't have that for Resident Evil, I don't think. They have it for Skyrim. I think it would be easier for me to, well, Skyrim's kind of neat, I guess, because you can do magical spells and you control your sword with the wands, and that's fun, but I'm more used to walking around with the controllers and having the added access of being able to look around.
Right.
Is just like a neat extra layer you don't have to think about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
you don't feel the game fighting.
Have you played, or do you have access to, rather, the Rick and Morty VR?
No, it's not out yet. It comes out next
month. Oh, it's not. Oh, okay. I'm going to get it. I remember seeing stuff for it like a year ago.
No, I think they might have done like a demo or something for.
Yeah, because Justin Roiland's like obsessed with VR, so he was posting all kinds of weird shit about it like last year. So I just assumed it was a thing that already existed that I didn't have access to. That's cool.
Yeah, the Rick and Morty one comes out next month, and I'm excited just because I know Justin Roiland is kind of like a VR freak. So that should be fun.
Yeah. Do you ever like feel embarrassment at your like of that show now?
A little bit. Yeah. Just because, are you talking about because the fan culture around that show sucks?
So for people who don't know, like, yeah, Rick and Morty is one of my favorite shows. Dan Harmon is one of my favorite, people. And I think Bobby probably feels the same way. And there's this, like, weird, like, toxic fan base that's been building out of Rick and Morty for the last, like, 3 years. It's
just people who legitimately don't understand the show, too, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Like that show is not...
Who think that Rick is a hero.
Right, and people who jump around yelling Pickle Rick, thinking that's a joke, when Pickle Rick, in the context of the show, is not a joke.
It's such a dark episode. Yeah.
But Rick and Morty's a really great show. It's really smart, and it's incredibly human, and
so,
I love it.
So, like, I agree, but there's also a bunch of idiots out there who keep saying... who keep, like, jumping on tables wanting Szechuan sauce, and then saying that... you're not smart enough to understand the show that they love. So, like, I also feel, like, really conflicted about even saying the show is... You know what I mean? Like, I've never had this experience this strongly, where something that I think is really, really excellent is actually being ruined a little bit for me by the world that exists. Like, that
this is
the world that is taking it in.
This is a double hurt for me, because I have, for 20 years, been talking about how... McDonald's Szechuan sauce that promoted the movie Mulan was delicious and was the best McNugget sauce that Mulan ever had.
A, I didn't know this. B, this is the most hipster thing you have ever said.
No,
I was in the Szechuan.
I was
sauce
on the ground
way
floor of this.
Before it was cool.
No, I'm not. I'm gonna take it to a non-hipster place.
I'm messing with you. I'm sure. I 100% believe you. I just want.
And so
to,
when
that's
like
funny.
When Rick. In Rick and Morty, there's the first episode of the third season. Rick uses not time travel. He uses like mind travel to go to McDonald's in 1996 to get Mulan Szechuan sauce at McDonald's, and talks about how it's the best thing they ever made. And that felt like a joke that was tailor made for me.
Right,
I got
so
excited.
Yeah, because he also like basically says like this has actually been my principal driving character motivation for the entire show. You just didn't know. Like that's like the only thing that drives him is getting access to this sauce again.
And so the shitty Rick and Morty fan base has made like this cultural thing out of getting Szechuan sauce from McDonald's, and McDonald's seems to want to half-heartedly play into it, which is to not bring the sauce back. But to only bring it back in limited quantities so that their poor employees get, like...
Yeah, their poor
minimum overrun
wage.
And abused.
Yeah, exactly.
But
that's what they want, right? If you work at McDonald's, you really want to become part of a viral video. That's your dream.
But I don't... This is speaking from someone who has tried it and who loved it at the time. It just tastes like like your standard Chinese food sauce. Like, it's not anything great. It's just like,
you just were excited that it was available at McDonald's.
Right. And people are losing their minds over this. I'm like, don't. You're going to be disappointed. It's,
well, they're,
it's
not
stupid.
They're losing their minds over feeling like they're in on the joke. That's what they're, you know what I mean? Like, these are the
but
same
people.
But
they're not who, in on the joke. They're,
no, of course not. These are the same people who used to walk up to the Three Stooges and poke them in the eye. Like, it's, this is exactly that. It's people who,
yeah,
like, who just their fandom is like toxic. They don't understand what they're, you know, I don't know. Yeah, okay. We can,
let's just pack up and go. What's the point in this?
Rick and Morty is really, really great, though.
It's great. It's very great.
Okay, that's, I think that's all. I just have been thinking that for a while. I've been thinking about that for a while. Because I'm, like, at the point where I'm kind of embarrassed to say in public. Like, I feel like it's, like, the same thing as saying I'm really into Family Guy, which I'm not, by the way. But, like, that you know what I mean? Like, it's,
yeah,
it just, it has a connotation attached to it now that bums me out. I don't think that's going to last, for the record. I think, first off, the creators are not on those people's sides, and eventually they're,
oh, not at all.
Yeah. And then
not
I
even a little bit.
And I think they're not at all interested in pandering towards those people, so eventually they're going to drop off because toxic fandom doesn't last, but yeah.
But there's this insane thing that happened last season, too, where last season was great, by the way. Season 3 was on par.
Why have we not
done
an entire episode where all we do is talk about Rick and Morty, by the way? We should do that.
I don't know.
Soon.
Season 3 was on par, in my opinion, with 1 and 2, which
I think season 3 is my favorite, which I did not even realize there was a backlash to season 3 until way later, and that blows my mind.
The backlash involved Dan and Justin realized that they didn't have any women in the writer's room, and so they hired women for the writer's room.
Is that right? I didn't know that's where. Oh, this is now toxic in like a whole new way. Fuck all of these people.
And
season
so
3 was amazing.
The women writers started getting harassed because they got blamed for the perceived drop in quality, which that boggles my mind because that show's great.
The Rick Lannis conspiracy is one of the best 30 minutes of television I've ever seen.
God.
At the very least, one of the best episodes, maybe one of like the top 3 episodes of Rick and Morty. But, like, one of the best things I've ever seen on television.
When we run out of ideas, we should each pick an episode of Rick and Morty and talk about
that. Yeah, 100%.
Like, maybe when season 4 comes out or something.
Yeah. There's other stuff I want to talk about this week. I just totally derailed us. Sorry.
I did, too. Whatever.
I'm almost done with Mario vs. Rabbids. It's really, really fun. Have you beaten the story mode?
Dude, I haven't played it since last time.
No. I mean, but you didn't. How much had you played? I never asked
like,
how much you.
Like 15 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. Yeah, it's great. Game. You should.
I'm free
play
of Zelda, so I might go. Now.
Bobby texted me at 3 a.m. saying that he beat Zelda, and then talked to me about it for like 20 minutes before we started the show. And I kept saying, "Why don't you just save this for the show?" And he just really sadly, like, at himself, said, I don't want to talk about Zelda on the show anymore.
The only thing I will say is that there's nothing more exhilarating than driving around a big monster Ganon on a motorcycle and firing light arrows at him.
I will say, I forget this about Mario or about Nintendo games a lot. The end is never the point. And so there's, like, this weird existential crisis you go through right when you beat a Nintendo game because the journey was always the point. There's never you end the game and you save Zelda or you rescue Peach or you kill the last Metroid or whatever. Like, there's never like, it's not like
maybe the Legend of Zelda was the friends we made along the way.
Yeah, exactly. And so whenever you finish it, I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have rushed it. So I think you made the better choice by milking every drop you could of that game. But
Breath of the Wild, more than any Nintendo game, I think, has the potential for a compelling story. Like, there's a real...
Oh, you told me, that's right, you told me there's a lot of really interesting story in the memories, right? Which I didn't do at all. When you go and search out your lost memories.
There's this, well, to just get into it very briefly, there's this layer of sadness that sits over the mythos of Breath of the Wild, which is that 100 years ago, Zelda rallied her friends to prepare for the arrival of Ganon. And it was kind of her first action as a leader, and it failed miserably, and everyone died.
Yeah.
Except for Zelda, and Link barely survived, and right. So...
Which was interesting to me, because those games always have a backstory like that, but it's always suggested that it was, like, thousands of years ago, and it may have been that they're talking about another Zelda game. And it took me a while...
Yeah, and it usually is.
Yeah, and it took me a while in this one to realize, oh, this is not that. This is, like, a backstory that actually happened in this world.
And so you go lost, to, you know, these different lands, and you kind of... Link is trying to regain his memories, and you kind of explore the fallout of these, the pillars of these communities dying.
Right.
You know, and you learn about Link's personal connections to them, and it's really interesting, but because of kind of the clumsy way that Breath of the Wild presents that story, it doesn't ever really connect, and I just wish it had leaned into that story a little more, because I think it could have been really effective.
I feel like we're going to get a really, really interesting next Zelda game. By the way, I love Breath of the Wild. That's not what I'm saying. But, like, I think that this is going to be the transition between, like, Grand Theft Auto 3 and Grand Theft Auto 4. You know what I mean? Like, they're working out new mechanics, which Nintendo
they
does
tore
very well.
Everything
but they,
down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's it, though. We can't talk about Breath of the Wild anymore.
Yeah. Okay, that's fair. One last thing I do want to say about it, though. Did it bug you how much the... What are the bird people called?
The Rito?
Rito. I knew it started with an R. Did it bug you how much that their guardian guy is just Falco?
Yeah.
Like, it's 100% just Falco. Like, even in, like, the character design. But, like, everything about him is just Falco with a bow and arrow. It was really weird. It didn't bother me. It just was like... Okay, Nintendo.
You know what the stupidest thing I've read about Zelda mythology while reading wikis and stuff about Breath of the Wild?
I'm so happy that you just said that sentence, but continue.
The Rito were introduced in Wind Waker.
Yeah.
In which the world is flooded, right?
Yes, yeah.
And the Rito are supposed to share, like, a genetic ancestor with the Zora, who are the fish people.
Oh, okay.
And so... Breath of the Wild is supposed to posit, because the Zora are not in Breath of the Wild, that the Zora evolved into
Wait,
the
they
Rito.
Are. They absolutely are.
Oh, no, not Breath of the Wild. I'm sorry, Wind Waker. The Zora aren't in Wind
Waker. Oh, okay, okay. Oh, they're not in Wind Waker. Okay.
Wind Waker is positing that the Zora evolved into the Rito, which is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, because I don't know why the Zora would take a moment where they would just reign over the world, because everything is water.
Well, and also, like, evolution's not real.
Oh, well, yeah.
Like, I mean, if we evolved from monkeys, why are there still monkeys?
No. On the 26th day, God created Rito.
Yeah. Okay. Glad we got that settled.
No. I'm just talking in this hypothetical video game that is turning me evil.
What else have I been doing? Oh, speaking of Skyrim, I think that's going to be my next Switch purchase. It's, like, the Game of the Year edition, right? They have all the DLC for it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been really wanting to go back. Last time I played Skyrim, I was writing my dissertation. This was 2012, and I still laugh at myself about this. I came out of my room one day with a copy of it in my hand, gave it to my best friend Shannon, and said, "You need to take this, and you need to put it somewhere and not tell me where. And in about a week, I'm going to tell you that I'm just kidding and I want it back, and you need to not listen to me." Like, I had to get her to hide it for, like, a month, because I just wasn't writing. I couldn't get anything done.
So I was
excited to go back to that one.
When I was a kid, I got a copy of Dr. Mario for NES, and I was really excited about it. And I got my mom to play a game with me. I had to have been, like, 6 or 7. I got my mom to play with me. And my mom got legit addicted to Dr. Mario.
And so isn't that great when you suck them into your world a little bit?
And she was playing this long after I just got sick of Dr. Mario.
Yeah. Your mom's
the
best. And
so she took my NES cart of Dr. Mario, and hid it behind books on the bookshelf so she wouldn't be tempted to play it. But there was, the way our house had been built, there was this space between the wall and the bookshelf that was, like, you know, nailed to the wall.
Yeah.
And so it slipped into that space.
And she lost it.
Yeah, it was gone forever.
Oh, no.
And then she went out and bought Dr. Mario for Super Nintendo so she could play it again. I can't play it anymore because it reminds me of my mom stealing my game and losing it.
That didn't make you excited? I would have been so stoked if my parents, like, wanted to play video games with me.
I was excited, but then also my parents would, like, my dad had a baseball Super Nintendo game that he would play with, like, my grandpa or my uncle for hours every time they came over, and so I couldn't play Nintendo or use the TV, and they would just play Super Nintendo baseball for hours. And
for the record, Bobby has, like, cool parents. Like, and I don't mean, like, oh, Bobby's parents are cool. I mean, like, your parents were probably both pretty cool people in high school. Like, they, like...
Oh, God. No, I don't know about that.
You don't think so? Like, I think no. Both of your parents are very good-looking. They're very, like, confident.
Why don't you
and, like,
back off, Ian?
Oh, my God. I just feel like you're... Like, my parents were... My mom was cool. My dad was a dork. But your parents were, like... cool people. Like, they, like, they still are. Like, they go out and do, like, fun weird shit, and I don't know, your parents make me laugh. I growing up, when we first got a computer, my dad would buy us computer games, and I did not know this until way later in life. This, like, makes me laugh so hard. I don't know if I've ever told you this. My dad would always really be good at them, and he would, like, help us figure them out. Like, he would get us, like, Myst and, you know, Warcraft and stuff like that, like, way back in the day. And I found out years later that he would, like, go to these, like, mom-and-pop game stores and ask them what the best games were. He would, like, describe us to them, and then, which is, like, adorable already.
That's
and then
he'd so buy
these,
nice.
And then he'd buy these games. But then he would buy the, like, player manuals, like, the strategy guides, and beat them in the middle of the night over, like, a week before he gave them to us, so he knew everything in the game, so he could be, like, cool dad who knows. Isn't that insane?
And he kept that a secret?
Yes, he never told
amazing.
Us that. Yeah,
that's so good.
Yeah, so my dad like knew every secret of Myst, and I could never figure it out.
There's no one knows every secret of Myst on their own, by the way. That's the
well,
thing.
Well,
I mean,
I was like 9, you know, and like you look at when you're 9 years old, you look at your parents, your dad, especially for me, at least, like, you know, he's a god anyway. So it just checked out for me that he would be naturally good at this.
I have revisited Myst in the last 8 years, and I got like 30 minutes into it, and I'm like, this is boring. I don't want to do this anymore.
It's boring, but that, like, I think that game is unparalleled in the tone that it sets. It's so, so creepy.
I read the book and stuff, too.
Oh, my God.
I got really into Myst.
I never played Rift, the like, spiritual sequel. I heard it was really good. One of my my roommate, Eric, that I talk about on the show sometimes, or my old roommate, Eric, played a bunch of the later ones, and they're crazy hard. You have to, like, keep a notebook.
Yep. I mean, that's the fun for people who like Myst.
Yeah. I mean, that's Eric, too. Eric is a very, like, puzzle-oriented person, so.
But, well, Eric, you're a nerd.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Eric. says the two people who have talked about nothing but Rick and Morty and Zelda for the last 30 minutes.
Since we've decided that this is going to be a 3-hour episode and you're editing it anyway,
I
want to touch on one more thing I had written down.
Okay.
I talked to you about this briefly, but one of my go-to comfort, like, albums that I listen to is a recorded production of 12 Angry Men that I have on Audible, starring Jeffrey Donovan and Dan Castellaneta and a bunch of other people. And it caused me to revisit both filmed versions of the movie.
Which I loved growing up, and I haven't seen since I was probably in high school.
And the Sidney Lumet version with Henry Fonda is fucking incredible.
Yep.
Like, it's a perfect movie.
It's really, really distracting that Piglet is in there. Because he just sounds like Piglet.
He plays juror number 2. And that is good casting, because Piglet would be juror number 2.
Do they have names? They have names in the play, right?
No, they're by number.
They don't refer to them as by the names? You don't know the character names? Oh, wow.
No, in some versions of it, juror number 8 and juror number 11. No, juror number 8 and 9 introduce themselves at the very, very end of the play, sometimes.
Which one is Henry Fonda? Is he 1?
8.
He's 8, okay.
One is the foreman. Oh, Henry Fonda is juror number 8. Juror number 8 is, like, the hero of the piece. And there are like, 3 kind of antagonists in 12 Angry Men. They are juror number 10, who's a racist. Juror number 7, who has baseball tickets and just really wants to wrap things up, and juror number 3, who is kind of like the final hurdle to overcome in the play. Anyway, right. It's the Sidney Lumet movie is incredible, and you should watch it if you haven't. But I, for the first time, watched the 1997 version for TV with Jack Lemmon. And
which I've seen as well. I think I saw it when it came on TV.
And it's okay. It's like not a bad. It's not terrible. Mm-hmm. But there's the weirdest. So to update it for 1997, there are both white and black men in the room, and also Edward James Olmos. But like, they
who,
made
who does he play?
He plays juror number 11, who's like in the play, he's like a German immigrant, and I don't know where he's supposed to be from in the 1997, but he's an immigrant. They make a reference also like to him being from Europe at some point, but Edward James Olmos is great.
He's Mexican, right?
Yeah.
That's weird.
But you know, that's cool.
Yeah.
But it's curious that they update that without putting any women in the room also. Yeah,
yes.
It's 1997.
Yeah.
But they make the weirdest change to the script, which is they take juror number 10, who's the bigot of the group, and they turn him into, like, a Nation of Islam dude.
And it that's doesn't... the real threat.
Yeah, but the bigotry in the original script... never explicitly mentioned skin color, and it's very much about class.
Right. And I thought the kid was Hispanic in the original.
He is. He usually is played as Hispanic, but like they never say anything about it explicitly, like verbally.
Okay.
They talk about class. Like it's not.
I mean, it's very clear based on, from my memory of the original, it's very clear based on intonation and the way this guy is talking about it that it is a race issue. But you're right.
It is. No, it's definitely a racial issue.
He's supposed to be one of those people who tells himself he's not racist by saying instead it's about these other things. So, yeah.
Exactly. And then by the end is just like a raving,
Trump-supporting lunatic. All comes out and he like says the thing that he shouldn't have said and everybody gasps. And
but the point is he never uses like a racial slur or anything.
Yeah.
And he always talks about how these people, you know, live in the slums and they're the lowest of the low, which I don't know like a ton about, you know, like militant Nation of Islam dudes living in America in the 90s, but I feel like that was more explicitly racial and not about class. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it wasn't like about. Yeah, you're right. That doesn't even translate. Do they keep the lines the same and stuff?
They do, and he calls him
like
a racial
slur. If he was a Nation of Islam guy, he would be only explicitly talking about race. You're right.
Right, and I imagine he'd mostly be talking about white people too. I don't know. Yes. I don't want to.
In fact, if class was an issue for him, he would most likely be on the side of the poor. God, like that's you're right. Like there's
so he,
even if you want to take that as a form of racism, it's not a one for one. Like the,
right,
yeah, like.
And so I don't know what that was trying to say. And they wrote in a racial slur for Hispanic people into the script that wasn't there before.
Huh.
So he calls him, you know, the S word at one point. And then, like, talks about, you know, these guys are the lowest of the low. You know, they live in the slums. And I'm like, oh, boy, this does not work.
Yeah, that doesn't check at all. That's really weird.
And
yeah,
then
literally,
I looked it up later.
You were texting me about this, and I wrote back, wow, I don't remember any of this. I literally only remember that Tony Danza is in that movie.
And Tony Danza's great. He's fun. But I looked it up later, and Reginald Rose, he wrote 12 Angry Men, updated his teleplay for the 1997 version.
Oh.
He wrote the teleplay for it. And
interesting.
I'm like, I don't know. It's just very surprising for me.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, that just sounds like a 2 a.m. idea that went wrong. Like, that's you know what I mean? Like, it was like, oh, what if I just do this? And then just stuck with it.
It's nuts. It was really weird. But anyway.
So we decided we're not going to be good this week.
I mean, we're 35 minutes in. We had finished two topics and the intro by this point last week.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get into our picks of the week. What do you say?
My thing is better than your thing.
Let's do it.
All
you
right.
Up first.
Yep. So I picked, so full disclosure, normally on this show, when I pick something, I have watched it already before I announce it, meaning for the next episode. And last week I totally forgot to come up with something in advance. And so I just picked something that I've been wanting to do for a while, but I didn't revisit before I suggested it. So part of our conversation today is going to be me filling in a little bit of blanks because I think it might have been better to watch two episodes, but I picked episode 9 of season 2 of an excellent show, Better Call Saul. It's a spin-off prequel series about Saul Goodman before he was Saul Goodman from Breaking Bad. What did you think of Better Call Saul, Bobby? So first off, have you seen any of the show before?
I have seen like the first 2 or 3 episodes right when the show started and have not watched anything since
I watched last night again because I decided to restart the show after I watched this episode and are really good. But I think this one is kind of drops you more in. It's a slow burn of a show. It takes a little while to get going.
Yep.
And so I dropped you really into the deep end here.
Rewatched the first episode because back 2 weeks ago when I was more naive, I figured I would just surprise you and watch the entire series. And
oh my
I ended
God,
up watching...
would have been amazing. That would have made me so happy, Bobby.
I ended up watching this episode and the pilot, and that's it.
Okay, all right. So do you want to briefly describe either the show or what happens in this episode, however you want to
Yeah, I want to start by saying, like, Breaking Bad is one of my... I don't want to say this definitively because we're going to talk later, but like
if you
had a gun to my head and said, what is your all-time favorite show? Breaking Bad would probably be my answer. I love Breaking Bad.
I mean, it's top 5 for me for sure. It's an undeniable show.
And so I was really happy to jump back into this world.
Which feels like Breaking Bad in a good way, right? Like it doesn't feel like watered down.
I'm surprised by how similar visually this looks to Breaking Bad, but how tonally different it feels.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
And I think it's because Saul is such a different character from Walt.
Right.
And
it's not a comedy. It's obviously not a comedy. It's really dramatic, but like it's lighter is not the word either. It's funnier, but it's not funny. I don't know. He's really good. So first off, Bob Odenkirk is fantastic. He's a really, really good actor. It's like really, it blows me away, like how good he is at everything he does.
Who is sitting on Bob Odenkirk this whole time?
I mean,
being like a really good actor.
I think he just didn't care about this side of things before he had the opportunity to try it. I mean, like he's great in everything he does, but he just does comedy for the most part. And I mean, yeah, he's amazing. So this entire show is really built on this relationship between two characters that I find fascinating. There is Chuck and Jimmy. Jimmy is Saul Goodman before he was Saul Goodman. Their names are Chuck and Jimmy McGill. Chuck is older. He's played by Michael Keane, and he is a once great lawyer who created the biggest law firm in New Mexico, Hamlin McGill. And he has, before the show starts, suffered obviously some kind of mental break where he has become convinced he is allergic to electricity, to the point where he, you know, exhibits physical symptoms, and he is a hermit at this point. He lives alone in his house. He's, you know, ripped apart the fuse box, and
he's
Jimmy
covered himself in thermal blankets all the
time. Yeah, yeah. And Jimmy, if people come in, they have to touch this thing outside that grounds them and leave all of their electronics in a mailbox. And Jimmy is basically his sole provider when the show starts. And the biggest, you know, the crux of their relationship is that Jimmy has a history as a con man in Chicago. And he got into a lot of trouble. You'll find out why and how when you get into the show. And Chuck basically saved him and brought him out here and put him in the mail room in his company to give him a second chance. And while he was doing that in the mail room, Jimmy secretly got his law degree and to impress his brother and started practicing law. At first, he wanted to practice at the company, and Hamlin, the other partner, came to him and said he couldn't. So Jimmy hates Hamlin. Eventually it comes out that Chuck was actually the reason he couldn't work there. Chuck basically thinks that Law is the most important thing in the world and that Jimmy's not worthy of it. That in Jimmy's hand, he basically says, I think he actually literally says at one point that Jimmy with a law degree is like a monkey with a machine gun. And the tragedy of the show is that he's right. We know he's right. We've seen what happens to Jimmy, you know? And it's still heartbreaking. So I would say Chuck is essentially the villain of the show, even though he's correct in his assessment of Jimmy. But it's also fascinating because the reason he's correct in his assessment of Jimmy is because of the way he treats Jimmy. Every single time Jimmy does something Jimmy-like and fucks up, Chuck gets worse. Chuck gets sicker. And every single time Chuck tries to stop Jimmy from doing bad things, Jimmy doubles down to spite Chuck. So they're destroying each other together through their love for each other. It's really, really weird.
That's interesting.
It's a great dynamic. It's like easily one of the best relationships I've ever seen on television. So previous to this episode, Chuck screwed Jimmy over again. And then do you want to basically describe what happens in this episode?
Yeah, so they're finalizing a deal for a bank, right? Where their client is a bank.
Yes.
And we find out that, or we don't, in a previous episode, I guess, Jimmy had forged paperwork.
Yeah, basically, so Jimmy has a love interest on the show who, for the first few seasons, is just his best friend. So their chemistry builds really slowly, too. It's really well done. I like the way they do the two of them. She brings this giant client into the company. And then because of Jimmy, she basically like gets demoted by Chuck. And then she leaves and brings the client with her. And then Chuck steals the client back just to spite Jimmy. Like, she keeps getting hurt because of Jimmy and Chuck's relationship, basically. And so Jimmy decides to get back at Chuck, and this is the fallout of that.
And so Chuck is humiliated in court because Jimmy has falsified documents to cause a filing error.
A very minor. He changes two digits in an address.
Uh-huh.
And it's brilliant. Like, he spends... it's brilliant in a couple of ways. Jimmy is an amazing character. It's small enough that it looks like a stupid mistake that actually causes problems. The amount of work that he had to put into doing it is so insane that anybody trying to accuse him of that would sound like a lunatic, because essentially he went into Chuck's house, stole every single file, went to a copy shop, changed every single number on every single page, photocopied it, put the fake ones back, and then 2 days later switched them back with the original so there would be no evidence of it. And it took him like 12 hours to do this.
And there's a really smart thing with the sound design where every time Chuck is kind of like trying to piece it together and he's questioning his own sanity as anyone would, you know, when he's being gaslighted so right. thoroughly, there's like, you just hear electronic noise.
Yes.
And the noise gets really, really loud and unbearable, and so you're just kind of uncomfortable watching Michael McKean, who looks incredibly uncomfortable every time he has to talk.
Yes.
But so he, the because of the clerical error, the bank can't open in time, which causes the bank to drop Chuck's firm and pick
and go
up
back to Kim.
Right.
And this is essentially a show about law intrigue, which sounds really boring. It's not. It's so compelling.
And so Chuck accuses Jimmy in front of Kim of doing exactly what he did.
Yeah. Which is like, it's a great moment because you realize how well they both know each other. And Jimmy, of course, does the brilliant thing of just like, what are you talking about? You know? And by the way, here's the thing, like, even though it's true, we do hate Chuck in this moment because Jimmy has been the only reason Chuck can survive as a human being for the last mm-hmm. 3 years. Like, he does everything for Chuck. Chuck recently, in like the last three episodes, finally allowed himself to have an assistant, which is the young black guy who's following him around in this episode. But until that moment, Jimmy has been doing everything. And basically financially supporting Chuck as well, because Chuck is not getting paid because he's not working.
Yeah, and so there's this great moment where he, you know, he spills out what he lays out exactly what Jimmy did, and Kim gets in his face and, you know, accuses him of lying, and also accuses, you know, lays bare his effect
on Jimmy. Yeah.
On Jimmy.
Yeah. It's the first time in the show where, like, all of this is said, just laid out on the table. Like, all the stuff we've been watching for two seasons of their relationship and how destructive they are to each other, somebody just says it to both of them. So it's really satisfying if you've been watching the show the whole time.
And so they leave. Jimmy and Kim leave. And as soon as they get in the car, Kim just starts punching Jimmy. And it's sort of heartbreaking because you get that she knows.
Yes. Because she also knows what he is.
Yeah. And later on...
Which, by the way, usually is so charming and so attractive. Like, he gets to show her this side of the world and, like, an ease with like, meting out justice to annoying people. And, like, he's been showing her these, like, tiny cons at restaurants and stuff just for fun. So she's, like, very attracted to that side of things as well.
And later on, Jimmy asks if she wants to talk about it. And she says... No, I never want to talk about it. And then also tells him, you know, if, you know, she speaks really vaguely, but basically says, like, I hope you have covered yourself, you know, beyond, you know, any
shadow of a doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. Beyond any shadow of a doubt, because, you know, this is insane. And so that causes Jimmy to go back to the copy shop where he made the copies and to pay off the clerk there.
In a really funny scene to me. I enjoyed that scene a lot. I like Jimmy's monologues, and I thought that was a great one.
Yeah. And so the clerk agrees to lie to Chuck if he comes in, because his assistant has already been in, right?
Yeah.
To question him.
Yes. And he's already said to the assistant, yes, I've seen this guy here.
And so Chuck gets there, and so Chuck goes and questions this clerk, and the clerk lies to him. And Chuck, again, is frustrated and also looks like he thinks he's going insane. And it ends with, that confrontation ends with Chuck fainting and losing consciousness while Jimmy watches across
the street.
And
hitting his head very hard on a counter as he goes down.
Yeah, and Jimmy watches helplessly across the street. And the last moments of the show are Jimmy whispering, call an ambulance.
Yes.
But meanwhile...
Yes. Okay.
The show starts with Mike Ehrmantraut, who is also a character for Breaking Bad, who's just, like, one of my favorite TV characters of all time.
He's amazing. I mean, he and Omar are probably my top two badass characters in anything ever. I'm basing my new Dungeons & Dragons character on Mike Ehrmantraut, by the way.
I'm done, dude. I don't want to play.
I'm so excited.
And so Mike Ehrmantraut lays out a nail strip to take down, or he lays down a spike strip to take down one of Hector Salamanca's drivers, right?
Yes.
He binds him up, leaves him on the side of the road, and steals money out of that are hidden in the tires,
mm-hmm.
but doesn't kill the guy. And then, like, later uses the money to buy a round of drinks at you know, a bar.
Yeah.
So I don't quite know what's going on between them, but it didn't feel incredibly important for the episode. Like, I get that.
It's not important for the episode in terms of why it's happening. It's fun because you get to see Mike being Mike and
right.
just being an expert at things. Basically, what's happened before this is Tuco and Hector Salamanca are characters in the show. Tuco basically... goes to prison over something that Mike was a witness for, and so he, you know, is one of the witnesses, and Hector threatens Mike's family, so he'll drop the you know, his statement, and it ends up not mattering, but Mike is literally only doing this, even though Hector's completely forgotten about him at this point, because his family was threatened. Like, he's just meting out this, like, invisible justice for him, for his own happiness. Like, he's gonna do this one job, and then that's it. He just wants to get Hector back for being a bad person, which is a very Mike thing to do. So that's all this is. Yeah.
And so he finds out later that, you know, even though Mike started this mostly harmless thing, you know, where he blows out the tires, steals money from bad people, and, you know, leaves everyone alive.
Yes.
That, you know, an innocent good Samaritan who stopped by the side of the road to help this driver has died because Hector didn't want to leave any witnesses. And then also that this driver is probably going to get killed too.
Right. Even though both of them don't know anything because Mike is Mike.
Right. And what I really love about these shows, about Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad, I don't know if it's Vince Gilligan or if it's, you know, different writers each time, but these episodes are always really, like, thematically taught, and they're named. They're named very well. And so this episode's called Nailed. And it starts, it's like the thesis of this episode, like right at the top is Mike lays out this nail strip that, you know, cripples someone.
Right. And which, then, by the way, in the previous episode, he was watching his granddaughter and she helped him make it, just so you know.
Oh, that's awesome.
he's like, hey, do you want to help me with some crafts? And he has her put the nails in the holes in the hose after he drills the holes in. It's great. Anyway, go ahead.
And, you know, and then eventually there's collateral damage that he hadn't intended.
Yes.
And meanwhile, Jimmy and Chuck are constantly just inhibiting each other and sabotaging each other until eventually there's, you know, it builds up to a moment of collateral damage that Jimmy obviously hadn't intended. And so what I'm saying is this was great.
Yes.
I really liked it.
It's a really good show. After you watch the rest of Legion, because you have to do that first, you should watch Better Call Saul, I mean. It feels like Breaking Bad. It's great. And there's all kinds of fun references to Breaking Bad in the show that are minor enough that they won't be annoying. So, for instance, in the pilot, or in the second episode, I'm sorry, Tuco shows up in a big way, and all of the other gang members with him are people who we've seen in Breaking Bad. For instance, one of them who he yells at is the guy who he beats to death in front of Jesse and Walt. There's a great moment in like episode 4 or 5 where somebody orders furniture and the guy shows up in the uniform and it's Crazy Eight who Walt kills with the broken plate piece and all this. So like there's really minor things like that just make it feel like they're living in the same world. And they don't hit you over the head with that stuff and it doesn't matter if you don't get it, but it's just really fun. It's a really good show.
Tuco was one of my least favorite things about Breaking Bad.
He's not in Better Call Saul a lot, but no,
in the first few episodes of Better Call Saul, Tuco's interesting, you know, like it's like they calibrated that performance better to what the tone of Breaking Bad eventually was, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Instead of him being this like coked out clown who's just screaming at people all the time.
Well, this is him. So part of this, his storyline in this show is the reason he's got to go away is like people make him go away on purpose is because he started using again. And they talk about how insane he is when he's doing drugs. And so that's like an explanation of why the version of him we see in Breaking Bad is so nuts and over the top. One of my favorite moments in the entire series is still in the second episode of the show where Tuco has taken Jimmy and these two kids who Jimmy was using in a con that had nothing to do with Tuco, but they accidentally got involved with Tuco. He's taken all three of them into the desert to kill them all. Jimmy talks himself out of being killed and then convinces Tuco that Tuco should be a judge. And Jimmy basically pleads the cases of the other two guys and talks them down from being killed to having one leg broken each. And it's like an amazing, amazing moment where you see like Jimmy's real ability. It's fantastic.
It's great. Yeah.
It's really good. This show is good, man.
Yeah. No objections here.
Okay.
I loved it. I mean, It's like it's a slam dunk for me, man. I love Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
so much.
I mean, it's just Vince Gilligan being Vince Gilligan with characters that we care about, and I mean, this shouldn't have worked as well as it did.
No, like, they took the one character who shouldn't have a spinoff from Breaking Bad.
Yeah. And I remember literally thinking it was a joke when I first read about it, and then thinking, "Oh, it's gonna be like a comedy, some kind of weird like comedy version of Breaking Bad." Like, but it's so good.
Mm-hmm.
I've been telling a bunch of people to watch it, and everybody says, "Oh, I tried it and didn't like it." Watch a few episodes; it's so good. I don't know why it's not more popular.
That's not the case with me, by the way. I'm bad at keeping up with shows.
No, yeah. But yeah, everybody said like, well, I mean, I just don't need to see a whole show with that guy. And I'm like, yeah, that's what you think, but you do need to see a whole show with that guy. It's really, really well done. Yeah. Okay. Awesome. You want to move on?
Sure.
Experience life. Experience wonder. Experience laughter.
Experience sound.
Experience love.
Experience life.
Experience lust.
Experience peace.
Experience Bobby.
So we're gonna my pick. I'm trying to give you like a clear stopping point to plug in my
No,
steam.
I know, but you just went, it's my pick. It sounded very childlike. It was cute, Bobby. Bobby picked a really, really sad movie that made me really sad.
Yeah, I did. I picked The Last 5 Years, which is a film adaptation of a stage musical.
Yes.
It's
basically 500 Days of Summer as a musical. That would be how I pitched it.
No.
Why? Why no?
How is that the case?
Because it's about a relationship disintegrating portrayed through a fractured timeline, but with music.
I guess.
What
I don't
mean
know.
You
last
guess?
5 years
That's
is
exactly
real...
what it is.
Last 5 years is real upbeat, but it's also about like a guy learning to not like invest and project so much onto another person, you know?
Let's talk about him, because I have a lot of things to say about both of them, but you go first.
About Joseph Gordon-Levitt in 500 Days of Summer?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. I hate you so much.
Okay, so Last 5 Years, I was introduced to this, to the musical by my friend Lauren, who's another podcasting partner of mine.
Okay.
But, it's
Wait,
like...
your girlfriend?
No, Lauren.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Lauren, who's one of my co-hosts on Independence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. I was like, wait, I know who Lauren is. What are you talking about? Sorry, go ahead.
But so the gimmick of the musical is that it tells the story of a 5-year relationship between these characters, Jamie and Kathy.
Yes.
Jamie is played by Jeremy Jordan, and Kathy is played by Anna Kendrick.
Yes.
And Jamie is going forward in time, and Kathy is going backward in time.
Oh, I guess I didn't see it. Think about it that way. I see what you're saying. Yeah, the ones from her point of view and his point of view. Got it.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's interesting. So in the stage musical, they take turns. Like every song is just basically a solo with one person on stage singing.
Okay.
And then that person leaves, and the only time they are on stage together is a duet they share in the middle where they get married, and then at the very, very end.
What about the story?
What do you mean?
The story that he tells her. She's not on stage with him during that?
Not in the stage show.
Okay.
Oh, no. No, she's not. She's not.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. And so in the movie, that would look insane. So, of course, they're incensed together.
Right. Yeah.
And I think it navigates that pretty well.
Okay.
But anyway, the story with their relationship is Jamie is a writer and Kathy is an actress. And Jamie's career takes off absurdly quickly.
Yes.
And he becomes like a prolific writer. They're both in their 20s, and he becomes a prolific writer very quickly, and gets success at a rate that most people don't, while Kathy is a struggling actress whose career
yes.
is just sort of dead on arrival. Like, she is not getting any of the auditions she wants, and she's kind of stuck just doing these summer reviews
right.
in Ohio.
Right.
and they start to resent each other. But yeah.
So first off, I really, really, really like this. I'm messing with Bobby a little bit. It's very real. So if you've been in a relationship that disintegrated for reasons that felt like they were out of your control, like, it will emotionally affect you. So I did find it very affecting. I think I had two complaints. One is that Anna Kendrick is an amazing singer. I don't know how good she is at singing and acting at the same time. She has, like, kind of a dead face a lot of times when she sings, in my opinion. Did you notice that at all?
No, because I was going to say, I think Anna Kendrick is, I've heard people say that, but I think Anna Kendrick is doing something really interesting here. Like, I think she's doing really small, nuanced acting while she's singing. And I don't think it's just dead face. Like, I think she's...
When she's belting is what I'm talking about. I think when she, like, gets to, like, have these, like, fight songs and stuff, I liked her in the movie, by the way, a lot. I just... There were moments where I didn't as much, especially when she was, like, kind of belting. But I will say, what's the guy's name, the actor?
Jeremy Jordan.
Jeremy Jordan was fantastic. He blew me away. I had a harder time with liking. The infidelity stuff is really hard for me to get around.
So I
was trying to figure out, like, how we were supposed to feel about him. And I felt a little muddied by that, because I do think the play is trying to portray him as sympathetic and wanting to learn something too. And I had a hard time getting there. But overall, I think it's really, really, really well done.
So an interesting thing about the play, it's written by Joseph, or no, not Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Let me take that again. The musical is written by Jason Robert Brown, who is actually the piano player we see a few times in the
movie. The one that she yells at?
The one that she yells at, and he's also the one in the apartment building in the very beginning playing the piano. He wrote this autobiographically about his first marriage that fell apart. I don't know how autobiographic it is. Like, I wonder if he, you know, cheated on his first wife similarly. But I always found that interesting, because I do find that the musical is presenting Kathy to be a little more of the sympathetic character.
Right, right. I think her biggest flaw is that, yes, it is pretty clear that she is having a hard time with him having success, and that's not a super likable trait, I guess, but that doesn't compare to me, for me, with him having a whole song about wishing he could fuck other people, and then his next song being him in bed with a bunch of other women. Like, that's, you know what I mean? Like, that's...
He's
very charming. Like, he's written super well. I'm curious whether the guy who wrote this sees himself as Kathy or as Jamie, though.
There's a brutal, brutal moment in the second half of the movie where he has a lyric. They're fighting over whether or not to, because Kathy doesn't want to go to this party that the publishers of his book are throwing, because she hates kind of like being this accessory who gets abandoned at these parties. And also clearly because she's resenting him for the success he's having. Right.
Which is painful, because at first she doesn't hate it, and then she, like, learns to hate it. That's, like, one of the things that was hard for me about the musical, is that the things that destroy them are there from the beginning, which is really interesting.
Yeah, she has a song sort of at the beginning where she talks about, chronologically,
I get to be part of it. And
yeah.
Yeah. And there's a lot of "I'm fine, we're fine." That refrain was, like, really hard for me. The fact that that's the song right before you know they're going to break up is, like, so heartbreaking.
And he has this lyric where he lays it out verbally to her, you know, where she goes, you know, I won't lose because you can't win.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's so cutting. And because they're both in the scene together, you have Anna Kendrick in the foreground, and you see her heartbreak.
Yeah.
Like,
and
right.
It's in a song. It's in a song that began with him singing about how he believes in her. That was, I think, the other thing is, like, there's these songs that start out beautifully and end up in flames, and it's those fights that you don't know how you got there, and you keep getting pulled back into them even when you're feeling positive. Like, it's
And the uncomfortably real part of that song is you know, at the very end, after he's, you know, started with a pep talk, turned it into this thing where he's, you know, righteously accusing her of not being okay with his success because she's not successful.
Right.
He kind of, like, gets on his knees in front of her and goes, okay, so can we just, like, put this all aside and just go to this stupid party? But, like, there's no coming back from that.
Yeah.
And she storms into her room and he's really frustrated that she won't just put it all aside and go to the party. Like, that, ugh, you know?
I think there's one of my favorite moments in the entire thing was the story song, the one he sings to her about Shmuley the tailor.
The tailor from Klimovich.
Which is like a beautiful song, and it's him being ostensibly very, like, he basically, she comes home from work, she's had this horrible day, and he writes this song for her and puts on this whole show for her to, like, cheer her up that he's been working on all day. And it's beautiful and it's sweet and it works, but it's also very clearly not what she wants or needs in that moment, and he just doesn't see or hear that at all. And so it's, like, sweet and beautiful and also so heartbreaking at the same time.
What I always find really interesting about this is, because the nature of how this is structured, you start with extremes, you kind of go to a happy middle, and then you wind back in extremes again.
Right.
And, at the end, I think the saddest and most heartbreaking moments for me are Happy Kathy at the end.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just because
the last song is juxtaposing him leaving after their first date and him leaving for good. Yeah. And she's singing happily about him leaving at the end of her first date, and he's singing sadly about walking out for good.
That's she's singing goodbye until tomorrow, and he's singing goodbye, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just that song, I mean, that song is so crushingly and oppressively sad.
Yes.
But also, you know, even her singing to him about, there's a song, her song before that is, she brings him back to her hometown, and she's singing about, you know, she starts talking about her friend who got pregnant in senior year,
mm-hmm.
and how she doesn't want to be stuck in this town, and how she's, you know, has these big dreams imagined for herself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all she wants is, you know, like she has these dreams she wants to follow, and she's in the middle of this new relationship that she's seeing blossoming. And just seeing, knowing the outcome of that, knowing that her acting dreams are basically fizzled, and mm-hmm. that her relationship with Jamie is going to end in heartbreak is just really tough to watch play out. Even though that's a very happy and triumphant song.
No, it's beautiful. It's an insane moment. There's two things that I want to say that I wrote in my notes. One, there's a line where Anna Kendrick talks about how she, I think it might be in that song actually, how she like got her life back together and lost 20 pounds at one point in her past. And I was watching that play, and I was like, if Anna Kendrick lost 20 pounds, she would die. That girl is 4 feet tall.
Anna Kendrick is tiny.
Yeah. She's, but anyway, and then the second one was, I think I texted you about this. I hope this doesn't come off as homophobic, cause I 100% do not mean it that way. I mean it very literally, but that second song where they have the first time they have sex is a musical number. And it is the gayest heterosexual sex scene I've ever seen, because it's just him starting to make out with her and then jumping off of her and doing a dance number in a high falsetto voice with, like, people dancing around behind him, and then jumping back into bed and then doing it. Like, it's just it's a sex show tune. It's hilarious.
Oh, man. I had never thought of it that way. You sent me that text, and I didn't know what you meant.
Yeah,
and then you tagged it with, I don't mean that in a homophobic way, and I'm like, I have literally no idea what he's talking about.
You get what I'm saying, right?
Now that you, that's funny.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, and I was really terrified that you hated the movie at that point.
No, like, no. I just thought it was, I did, when I heard the opening song, I will say I was like, oh, I don't want to watch a whole movie about this girl crying about a guy that she lost. But then I definitely got sucked in. It worked very well. It takes a lot for me to get over something being just about a relationship. I don't know what my issue is there. I need something more. And this definitely got me there. I'm not complaining about it. But yeah, I definitely was not excited for the first 10 minutes, I will say.
I'm glad that you got there, though.
Yeah. I really, really enjoyed it. It's a really good movie, by the way. You guys should watch it. I could see how the stage play would maybe be better in some ways. I mean, it's mm-hmm. really minimal. Because of the nature of it, there's not a lot visually interesting to do.
So and the one time they sort of attempt a production number, there's a moment where people sort of, like, do a choreographed, not quite a dance, but there's, like, crowd movement behind Jamie in one of the early numbers, and you're like, what the hell's happening? It feels weird.
Yeah, so I think that's a little uneven. The opening song, I remember thinking, I'm like, this is literally just her in a black box singing. Like, and they could have done that with every song and had them work. I think the high point of the movie for me was the Shmooly song, both tone, message. The song was great, and then like visually, I thought it was really interesting as well. But I liked it a lot. That guy's good. I only know him as the comic relief on Supergirl, and I like him as mm-hmm. that. But he was really good in this. I was really impressed.
Charming as all get out.
Totally.
One more thing I want to say is there's like an interesting symmetry. To the movie, visually at the beginning you have Kathy sitting on the end of the bed mm-hmm. is how that number starts, and then there's a very similar shot toward the end of Jamie sitting on the bed, you know, after he's cheated on her,
right?
But then there's like musical and lyrical refrains that like pay off later, like when they're fighting on the docks at the beginning. Kathy has a lyric where she says, you know, it's all about you and you and nothing but you.
Mm-hmm.
And then
I forgot about that. Yeah.
She's singing a happy song where she says like, I want you and you and nothing but you in the same, with the same, you know, like melody.
Yeah. Wow. I had to split it up over 2 days. I guess that escaped me. That's really well. You're right. That's good. I like that.
No, I'm not. And the point is, Jamie, that you can't spend a single day that's not about you and you and nothing but you. Marvelous novelist, you. Isn't he wonderful? Just 28, the savior of writing. One you and you and nothing but you. Miles and piles of you. Finally, I'll have something worthwhile to think of.
Jamie, at the end of the gayest heterosexual sex scene ever, says something like, I think I could be in love with someone like you.
Mm-hmm.
And then after he, during his song where he's cheating on her, he, when he's singing to Elise, who in the movie is like his, what is their
publisher,
relationship?
I guess?
Yeah, like the publisher assistant or something. Mm-hmm. He ends that song with, if I need to be in love with someone, maybe I could be in love with someone like you.
Yeah.
And he says it in the same tune. There's just little things like that. The piano intro for that first number is Jamie's song from the very, very end.
I need to rewatch some of this stuff then. Yeah, because a lot of that escaped me. That's really impressive. That's cool. The music's really good. It's really well written.
There's something that just really... I mean, it is kind of like a niche thing. Like, it is very much... like front to back a musical, like there's hardly any dialogue in this, but there's something just very unpretentious about it. It's all so straightforward.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes. There's not a lot of frills, and what makes it compelling is that every fight feels like a fight people like that I at least have had. Like like not literally, like I've never like cheated on somebody or like been too successful and had somebody else struggling, but like the way that the fight shifts back and forth to different areas and like everybody's confused and struggling to find words and all of a sudden it just explodes back out even though 3 seconds ago you were trying to get over it, like all of that works really, really well.
Yeah I agree.
Okay, we should move on because we're running long today. We decided to do something a little bit different with our third segment this week. Do you want to tell our audience what we're doing today?
So Ian sent me a text, and the text said, what is your favorite TV show of all time? In your opinion, best quality that you think you would recommend to anyone? Which I say, those are three different things.
Oh, I'm Bobby. I like to be contrary and have interesting opinions.
I'm breaking, so this is what we're talking about today. Yeah. We're talking about the best TV show, but I'm breaking it down into three criteria.
Okay.
One is your favorite, you know, like a show that you personally enjoy. You could watch over and over. Like your personal enjoyment is high.
Yes.
Two, quality, undisputed quality. You know, like, you know, people would agree with you. It has made an impact in culture. Yes. You know, that kind of thing.
And not just entertainment, I would say there, but like aspirational, like almost mm-hmm. like it deals with themes. It has messages to it. It's trying to say something.
Right. Like I enjoy, I don't know what to tell you, man. I only enjoy good stuff. but like, okay. Like I enjoy, God, I'm not going to undercut. Okay. I enjoyed Glee when Glee was
right,
on.
Right, right, right.
Glee would not have undisputed quality.
Yes, I agree.
Glee's kind of a mess.
Yeah. Or like a reality show. Like you can be really drawn into a reality show and know that's stupid. Like it's, you know, that's.
Don't lump all reality TV together. There's a show called Face Off that is so good.
Oh my God, I hate you. Anyway, continue. That's I think Face Off is stupid. It's really fun to watch, but it's stupid. They do the same thing every week and. It's, you know, what's going to happen. Like, it's, I mean, it, that's
but
what I'm
what
saying.
I'm trying like, to say is, like, there are certain reality shows that would, I would say, probably have undisputed quality. I just need to think a little bit.
Yeah, give me one.
Well, okay, I'm talking about, like, there's a cultural relevance to Real World in the 90s, right? Like, if you made
it.
I don't think that
means it's a good show.
You can make an argument that Real World is a best show.
I disagree, but I also didn't watch MTV growing up, so I might be the wrong audience for this argument. Anyway, we're getting sidetracked. What's your third criteria?
And then the third one, these are outlined by you, is recommendability. Like,
yes.
You know, you could recommend it to anyone.
Accessibility,
Yes, there we go. There you go, Dr. Ian with the words. And so I think the trick is finding a movie that balances the three of these most efficiently.
You mean TV show, you idiot.
Did I say movies?
Yes.
I think that the trick is finding a TV show that
I'm not cutting this out and fixing it for you.
All right. And so I'm going to go. I'll go. I would say I was thinking about this and my gut reaction is that Simpsons is the shoe-in.
Okay.
If we could stop it at around season 8 or 9,
yeah,
and I would fight people on that. But now we're at like the 30th season, and we sort of have to accept that Simpsons has way more subpar material than great material.
I think for me, part of the quality criteria is pound for pound, is the show, like if you had to average the quality of every episode together, and then put that average against another show's average, like what is the number? And I don't think Simpsons succeeds there.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
But God, it was really great.
No, for sure. But I mean, and so was The Office. I think for me, that's one of the reasons why The Office wouldn't make this list, you know?
Yeah. So why don't we both just say what our picks are?
So I think we both already know, right? I'm really interested to see how this conversation goes because there's
it's insane what we're about to argue.
So mine is The Wire. Which is, you know, an amazing show. I think that's pretty undisputed. And yours is what, Bobby?
Mine is Parks and Recreation.
Right. Which, by the way, I love Parks and Recreation. So this is going to be
painful for
me. Which you've never finished, so fuck you.
I haven't. No, I'm three seasons out of five.
Oh, my God.
But, so this is like comparing apples to shrimp. Like, it's...
Well, here's the thing. I don't think it is, and I will start by explaining briefly why I don't think it is. I think we picked two of the most politically relevant shows have been on television in the last 15
years. I would definitely agree.
I think both of these shows are extremely about the tragedy of the failure of bureaucracy and the triumph of people who actually care being able to do something about it. I think that Parks and Rec is a more optimistic show in that way. But I think that they are dealing with actually very similar issues.
That's interesting because I had written down as one of my my points for why I love Parks and Rec so much is because it does have an optimistic take on how one person could change systems. You know, yes. It is about systems and yes. about bureaucracy, but it's also about faith in people to be able to change institutions and right. move institutions. And that is true. Yeah. You know, like that.
I mean, I would say that Jeremy Jam is every single bureaucratic character that's an obstacle on the wire. Just he's done for comedic effect. You know what I mean? Like
he's Peter Baelish.
Yeah. Peter Baelish.
Oh, I forget his name in the way.
it's Mayor Carchetti, but
Carchetti. That's yeah. right.
I'm kidding. That just came to me. I didn't know if I'd be able to pull that out either. I think, you know what I mean? Like, I think that they're making the same joke with those two shows. Talk a little bit about what makes, so why do you think Parks and Rec is a better choice for this than The Wire? Let's start there.
Well, I think Parks and Rec is a slam dunk for all three of these criteria. Like, it is one of my personal favorites. Sure. I could spend an entire day Netflixing seasons of the show.
Same here.
It is infinitely watchable. Even the first two seasons, which are not as good as the rest of the show, are still great.
Yeah, I'd say when Ben comes in, that's when the show really becomes golden. Although, I think the second season is really strong, too. The first mm-hmm. season, they're still trying to figure out how not to be The Office.
I love how you can mention Mark Brandanowitz to people, and they're like, who's that?
Yeah.
Like, Paul Schneider, who's a great actor,
yeah.
Is like...
that was a thankless
you
job
for
him.
You completely forget yeah. that he was ever on the show. Yeah. But I also think, like we said, it's got undisputed quality. It's incredibly well-written. Like, mm-hmm. it's cast, like, amazingly.
The way that it is a microcosm of real, like... national political issues endlessly fascinates me.
Yes. And I got, you know, features appearances from John McCain, Joe Biden, yes. Michelle Obama, yes. Hillary Clinton, you know, like,
yes,
it's incredible. But also, you know, like the iconic characters and careers that came out of this show, you know, like, yes. I feel like this was the beginning of a moment for, you know, for Aubrey Plaza, whose April Ludgate was amazing.
Uh-huh.
Chris Pratt was, like, incredible in this show.
You're naming a lot of white people here.
Aziz Ansari. I was getting there, dude.
So there's one, is what you're saying.
There's a new show with Retta that seems pretty interesting.
I actually want to watch that show. No, that was one of my like dirty shots was going to be the diversity.
Also, Aubrey Plaza is not white, okay? She's even Hispanic in the show. Like, so why don't you lay off? But more than that, like, Leslie Knope has become a cultural yes. icon.
I mean,
know?
I like
she's grown further than the show.
Yeah, the fact that there was so much outrage when the NRA recently used a Leslie Knope gif is like very indicative of the fact that she has taken on a kind of cultural meaning in the world that makes me very happy.
It portrayed a like a really cool relationship between her and Ben.
Uh-huh.
To where like Leslie isn't just a, you know, like the strong woman character, like yeah. they truly feel like equals in their relationship
yes.
to the very end, where it teases that either one of them is president in the future and we're fine with either one of them being president.
Right.
But I
think Ben is maybe one of my favorite love interests in something ever. I every once
yes,
in a while when
he's
I'm
great.
When I'm
oh,
like, go ahead.
Shit. I was going to say Adam Scott was around forever, but this is the show that I think really, brought Adam Scott to the forefront
yeah,
as like a comedy,
true.
You know, a comedy star.
I mean, his portrayal in Step Brothers was that for me, but I totally agree with you.
Well, I really liked him as Jennifer Lopez's gay best friend in Monster in Law.
Oh personally. My God, are you serious? I did not even know that was a thing. Now I have to watch Monster in Law.
But
does he
that
do
was actually,
like a gay voice and stuff?
Yeah, that was. I think that was the first thing I ever saw him in.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's that's a movie that exists.
You know what's really weird? He has like a very substantial role in The Aviator.
Does he really?
Yeah, I mean it's not for the whole movie, but for the first third of the movie or so. Yeah, he's like I think he's his agent or something. He's in it a lot. Like a lot more than you would expect for The Aviator is all. He's not like a main character, but it's really interesting.
Do you remember when Leighton Meester accused him of rape in Veronica Mars?
Oh, you just really scared me. Yes, I do remember that. No. I thought you were talking about some kind of crazy. I forgot that was Leighton Meester. Yes, that's a great.
No, and that too. spirals out of control and leads to the events of the movie too. It's sad. Anyway, but so where I think, and God, I don't want to speak ill of The Wire because I think The Wire is incredibly culturally.
Yeah, go ahead
important.
And attack The Wire.
I think The Wire is incredibly culturally important, and It is a great, great show. But I think where Parks and Rec edges it out is its accessibility. Like, I cannot think of a single person I wouldn't immediately recommend Parks and Rec to and just be like, yeah, watch it.
Who,
no matter what mood you're in, watch
it. Why would you not recommend The Wire to somebody?
Because The Wire is really heavy and a little bit slow.
like, the first four episodes of the show are a little bit slow. I would say that about,
no,
that's about
I'd
it.
I'd say it's a patient show. And that doesn't mean it's a bad show.
Yeah.
Like, this is the same knock I would have against, like, Breaking Bad, which is probably actually my favorite show ever, Mad Men, is because they're a little bit slower, and I don't know that I would recommend those shows to anyone. Okay. I would recommend Parks and Recreation to literally anyone.
That's fair. I think that The Wire does a good enough job of throwing the gang stuff at you in a way that's compelling that the build of what the cops are doing in the first season going slow doesn't feel slow. But I get what you're saying. I think pound for pound, there are easily as many iconic characters from The Wire as there are from Parks and Rec. That would be my first kind of big rebuttal. I think the characters are big in a way that drives the story. I mean, this gave us American Idris Elba, which is amazing. Stringer Bell is one of the most compelling characters I've ever seen on television. Obviously, Omar is a huge one. I mean, what else?
It launched the career of baby Michael B. Jordan.
That's true. This gave us Michael B. Jordan. This is the beginning of him. Lester Freeman, I think, is,
Lester Freeman's great.
I mean, I don't think you get a more perfect character than Lester Freeman. And I think this show is so aspirational in its message. It like reaches like Shakespearean levels of storytelling. Like it's beautiful. The symmetry of this show, the world building of the show, and the kind of cyclical nature of it, the inescapability of corruption and violence and all these things in the show are just beautiful. And the follow through is insane. I read years ago, and this is probably still one of my favorite pieces of trivia about the show. There's only three times that a police officer shoots a gun in the entire series, and each time is either wildly reckless, meaning they're like drunk and shooting at bottles, or it's a mistake. So this show does not have a lot of violence to it outside of the criminal element. It's not about police shootouts. It's about what drives the drug trade and what drives us like as a society in terms of how we want to try to stop it and whether we actually do. It's just, it's really, really good. I mean, I'm being boring at this point, but it's,
no, you're not, because that's perfect. Exactly what The Wire is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's about, it's also about our, our institutions and place and how they function or don't function, how helpless or how empowered people feel working within those institutions.
I also will say that I think season two of The Wire, which is, I would argue, is the weakest season of The Wire, is better than season one of Parks and Rec, which is the weakest season of Parks and Rec.
I don't know if I agree with that.
You think that season one of Parks and Rec is better than season two of The Wire?
I don't know if it's better, but I don't. It's so hard to compare season to season Parks and Rec to The Wire. I think they're both great. I like season two of The Wire a lot. I do too.
I get why people get frustrated with it, but I love it.
I do think there are season one
Pablo,
of Parks and Recreation.
Pablo Schreiber is so good in it.
Pablo Schreiber is great in it.
Yeah.
Did you know he's Liev Schreiber's cousin?
Yes. I thought they were brothers, actually.
I think they're cousins.
Oh, okay. But yes, I didn't know that.
Did you see the weird car ad that everyone from season two of The Wire was in, like last year's Super Bowl?
No. What?
There's like a Prius ad that has like the stars from season two of The Wire.
No,
in it. It's
that's
weird.
Amazing.
But I do think season one of Parks and Recreation has a lot of moving pieces around to see where they fit and where they work the best.
Right, right.
And season two of The Wire feels like a singular vision.
Yeah,
like,
I don't think there's any point in The Wire where you feel like David Simon is figuring out what he wants to do. I think he knows right from the beginning, and it comes out running.
Yeah, I agree. I would say, would you recommend The Wire to, like, a gun-toting NRA member in Trumpian and say, like, you should watch the show and you would recommend it?
Yes, actually. I think the same reason, I think what you're getting at here is that there are, like, hidden messages in both of these shows, or at least you think there's, like, hidden messages in Parks and Rec, that it's more of a Trojan horse. Is that kind of what you're saying?
No, I'm just arguing accessibility.
I think that the show works on a pure, like, cop and criminal psychology level, and then if you want to go deeper into it, you can. I don't think there's anything on The Wire that's especially, what would be the word?
What I'm trying to,
like,
get out...
I don't think there's anything especially on that show that would push somebody away from it for that reason.
What I'm trying to get at is, on a very base and petty level, I can't imagine the NRA ever tweeting an Omar Cummin tweet, but you know, they have tweeted Leslie Note memes.
So you're saying that because there are racist people in the world who wouldn't like my show, that your show is better? Is that the argument you're making?
Fuck you, Ian.
That's literally the argument you just made.
God damn it. Now I have to concede to you just so I don't seem racist. It's like,
you're right, but that's literally the only reason you're right, is because Omar's black. That's the only reason the NRA is not...
Oh my god. I'm like, I tried to, like, pull off a flashy chess move and then, like, walked my way right into a checkmate. D'Angelo Barksdale, by the way, taught me how to play chess.
Yeah.
No, it's checkers. Oh, I'm kidding.
God damn it.
Is it checkers or is it chess?
It's chess.
They're playing...
It's chess.
They're playing checkers with the chess set, right? And then he teaches them how to play chess?
Yes.
The queen is Stringer Bell.
Yes. Which is an amazing... I love that moment. I always enjoyed that. Bubbles. What about Bubbles?
Oh, Bubbles is heartbreaking.
God damn it. That show is so good, Bobby.
What about Hamsterdam?
Is there anything on Parks and Rec that was as good as Hamsterdam?
I mean, yeah.
Like what?
I mean, like, what am I supposed to compare to Hamsterdam?
Yeah, I know. I'm saying I'm winning.
No,
here.
I mean, I could say, like, Little Sebastian's great, but that's a stupid thing to compare
to
Hamsterdam.
I would put those on equal playing field in terms of, I think you won that argument, actually.
But, no, because I think that's a dumb thing to compare. I think if we're going to compare, you know, our enjoyment of these shows and cultural relevance, we're going to keep hitting heads because they are A, different in tone, and B, both great, you know?
They obviously are. Oh, this is such a weird exercise in argumentation.
One of the moments, we're just talking about great things about both shows happening.
Yeah.
But, like, when a moment of television that, like, had scarred me emotionally, like, I cannot, is, like, Michael B. Jordan's big moment at the end of season one.
Like,
is one of the hardest things for me to watch. And, like, weirdly, him having a big career right now has, like, I don't know. There's no way to, like, not talk about spoilers in that, but, like.
People die on The Wire. Let's just...
Okay, now we've... I wonder what we're talking about then. But, like, seeing Michael B. Jordan, like, alive and as a grown-ass man is, like...
Yes. I feel like he's somehow...
Better.
Yeah,
I'm like, all right.
That scene is very, very affecting. I think there's moments like that in every season of The Wire, too. I think Ziggy's big, like, breakdown in season two and that scene between... Barksdale and Bell in season three. I mean, like, that show is so fucking good.
I mean, weirdly, even
you've only seen three. You haven't seen four or five.
I've started four, but four is really good.
Five, I think, is the weakest season, and it's still really good. I only think it's weak because it's the first time that the premise stretches credulity for me a little bit. But I really, really enjoy it still.
I was gonna say, even that scene between Omar and Stringer Bell and Brother Muzone.
Yeah, that's actually what I was talking about. That's what I meant.
Oh, you did? Okay. That scene's really heartbreaking, weirdly, too. You know? Yes,
that scene is amazing. Yeah, I mean, I may have told you this before, but I realized years ago when I was walking around teaching that I unconsciously physically hold myself the way that Stringer Bell does on that show, because in my mind that's just the ultimate like image of power and authority. Like I like do that weird thing where I walk around with my hands behind my back like he does. I'm sure I look nothing like Stringer Bell, by the way, that's not what I'm trying to say, but I just like I realized that that's where I got that from.
Man, I wish I could talk like Stringer Bell, but I can't get away with saying the N-word that much. Anyway, though, I have you on accessibility, and you're wrong, and you know it.
Well, I have you on trying to defend your show by saying racist people wouldn't like mine, so.
So, I want you to know that you've only won this argument because you pulled the race card. My God, do you ever read the Hollywood Reporter, do you ever read the, every year the Hollywood Reporter does they interview Academy members anonymously about voting?
No. I mean, okay. I maybe, but I don't, no, I don't think so.
So, it's always frustrating because you realize that the Academy voters are idiots and that they're like old white people.
Right, right.
And so this was an excerpt of one of them talking about Get Out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nominated for Best Picture.
You texted me this.
Deservedly.
But go ahead, yeah.
And so they're talking about their voting process, and this is the quote. "Then I eliminated Get Out. It's a good B-movie, and I enjoyed it, but what bothered me afterwards was that instead of focusing on the fact that this was an entertaining little horror movie that made quite a bit of money, they started trying to suggest it had a deeper meaning than it does, and as far as I'm concerned, they played the race card, and that really turned me off. In fact, at one of the luncheons, the lead actor, Daniel Kaluuya, who is not from the United States, he's British, was giving us a lecture on racism in America and how Black Lives Matter, and I thought, what does this have to do with Get Out? They're trying to make me think that if I don't vote for this movie, I'm a racist. I was really offended. That sealed it for me." My brain screamed the entire time I was reading that, because I'm like, how do you watch Get Out and go like, this is a fun little horror movie, and not see any of the deeper things that Jordan Peele was going for.
Didn't like Get Out, and they didn't leave the movie thinking that. That's ridiculous. That's so
right.
So stupid.
It's not even subtle. It's right there in the premise.
Well, I mean, I guess we can agree that The Wire is a better show, and
we are, but we're kind of winking at the camera as we do because, you know, deep down, Parks and Rec is the better show, but you're letting it.
I think the fourth criteria should be how many versions of the theme song there is.
Well, then Weeds would be the best show of all time.
Remember when Weeds was good?
Nope.
I do. There was a short period of time there.
I've only watched like the first two seasons and I liked it, but that was a long time ago.
My roommate Shannon was watching Orange is the New Black with me one time, and she just very quietly said, and it like blew my mind, she goes, "Jenji Cohen is very attracted to women in crisis." And I think that's like her fatal flaw. I think she takes women to these insane places and then doesn't know where to go with them from there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. We're starting a whole new episode of the show. Let's not distract ourselves. So what did we learn this week, Bobby?
We learned that you can pull a race card on me, I guess.
Yeah. That was really satisfying, I'm gonna say. That like I had a big ass grin on my face when I
left a big cage open and walked me right into it and slammed the gate shut behind me.
Oh man.
Hey,
yeah.
Ian.
Yes.
Oh, do you have something to say?
Oh, I was just gonna say, everybody watch The Last 5 Years. It's really good. I was talking about how sad it is, and it is sad, but it's very well done.
I'm so happy because that was such a wild card for me. I'm like, there's a good chance Ian hates this movie, and we talk about how much he hated it.
I thought I was going to for the first 5 minutes, but I was very charmed by it.
I'm glad,
even though it set me into a tailspin of depression. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. And Better Call Saul's great. If you have any hangups about watching a show about Saul Goodman, you should shut up.
Yeah. So you
can I ask you a question?
Yeah, please.
Oh no, go ahead.
No, mine was a stupid joke. Go ahead.
What was your stupid joke?
That next week I'm assigning you the entire rest of season one of Legion.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're a dick.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead. What were you gonna say?
Oh no. Go ahead.
I don't.
Do you want to do your recommendation?
Oh sure. I thought you were gonna ask me a question. This is stupid. So my recommendation.
You're gonna cut all that out, by the way.
Yeah, I know. So my recommendation for next week is a book, actually, which Bobby has graciously agreed to do. I feel a little bad. So thank you. So my pick for next time is a book called Feed by Matthew Anderson. It is a science fiction novel. It's very much a quick read. It reads a lot like an episode of Black Mirror. It's that kind of thing. It's a science fiction YA novel. And the reason that I feel okay giving it to you is it takes place in a future where basically everybody has Twitter in their heads. Or the internet in their heads constantly. And because of that, communication has stagnated. And so the entire book is written as if it is a 12-year-old millennial typing run-on sentences in their blog. Like, it's hard to explain. But there's not a whole lot of descriptive language. The narrator is very limited in what they're able to say, so it reads very, very quickly. So I think you should be able to get it done in about 4 hours.
I have been meaning to read this book for, like, 3 years, because I think your roommate Shannon recommended it to me the first time I talked to her.
Shannon got me into it, and she and I have both been teaching it for a couple of years now. Cool. And it's excellent. So that's my pick for next time. What's yours?
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you want to play a game?
Oh, God. Are we still doing this? I don't like this choose-your-own-adventure thing.
Every week.
Okay.
All right. So your choices are Austin, White, or Fox.
These are two of the same ones from last time, right?
Yeah, because I'm only coming up with one new one this week.
Okay. Fox.
All right. You've chosen Fox, which means we are going to wade into a medium we haven't done before, which is the YouTube video essay. So I, in a week where you're assigning me a book, I'm assigning you a 15-minute YouTube video.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine. I made you watch a movie this week.
Yeah,
that's fine. I'm giving you a video essay by Lindsay Ellis.
Okay.
Who used to go by the Nostalgia Chick. She's really great. She kind of does deep dives into Disney movies and old nostalgia and stuff. But she recently did a video essay series called The Whole Plate, which applied critical theory to the Transformers film.
Okay. This is why you've been asking me about
this. This is why I asked you about Transformers.
Okay, got it.
And they're all very good, but I'm only going to assign you her last one, which is called Framing Megan Fox, which explores the character of Michaela Baines, who Megan Fox plays in the first two Transformers movies.
Is character the right word?
The video essay will get into that.
Okay.
And you don't have to, like, brush up on the Transformers movies or anything. I've never even seen the second one. I've been thinking
about watching some of the later. I mean, I've only seen the first two. The first one was kind of fun, obviously not great. The second one just sucked. It was insane, so I never watched any of the others.
This video will only talk about the first and second and a little bit of the third. Okay. So, and yeah, you should feel proud because you chose the shortest item that I brought to the table this week. So use that extra time, Ian, to go out into the world and do good and pull a Leslie Nope.
I'm probably going to buy Skyrim and play that, but thank you.
I want to also say that, like, YouTube essays are often, like, dumb and shitty and pedestrian. And, I like Lindsay Ellis a lot. So.
Okay. All right. I'm looking forward to it. Well, thank you, guys.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. I don't know why you listened. We're if you want to listen to like almost 2 hours of people just like rambling incessantly about shit,
I don't get it.
Probably means you're friends with Ian. So,
but if, yeah, right. But it makes me happy. So thank you guys who listen. All right, man. Well, thanks, and I'll talk to you next time.
All right.
Bye.